Good morning and welcome to the International Connection here on CKLN 88.1. Today we are broadcasting show number 26 in a series on mind control. We're going to hear part two of an interview with Lynn Moss Sharman, the Canadian coordinator of AICSMC, that's the Advocacy Committee for Human Experimentation Survivors of Mind Control, and of the Stone Angels in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Through her work with these organizations, she devotes her energies to act as an advocate for other survivors of ritual abuse and mind control. The Stone Angels publishes journals with information for survivors, and AICSMC is currently engaged in a campaign to call for an investigation into government mind control experimentation in the United States and Canada. Lynn alleges that she had been used in government mind control experiments involving tortures, electricity, sensory deprivation, and sexual abuse. She has remembered names of doctors that are known to have been involved in the CIA's MKUltra mind control project, such as Jose Delgado and Ewan Cameron. And now, the second part of that interview with Lynn Moss Sharman.
More people contacted the Stone Angels, and as more Native agencies, Native service providers started to get in touch with us, a lot of this happened on an individual basis as well, we began to see that there were certain reserves, certain areas where there were intergenerational satanic cults operating, and these are comprised of Ojibwe people or Ojibwe Cree people. I can only assume that the creation and the maintenance of these cults over the decades or over generations were a direct result of the missionary activities, the religion that was imported by the British and the French through the fur trade centuries ago, and certainly as a direct product of the residential school experience. There is also known cult activity on Manitoulin Island, and some survivors described wealthy white people who were flown in from New York and from California to take place in highly organized, highly sophisticated cult activity at a site on Manitoulin Island. This is something that has been addressed within the Native community, and across Canada there is research being carried out by Native people themselves. They know where the activity is taking place, and they're dealing with it in their way. A group has formed in the Sault Ste. Marie, Cutler, Thessalon area, Survivors of Spiritual and Sexual Abuse. They are affiliated with elders and have recently received funding to sponsor, again, intensive healing gatherings directed and run by elders. And they are quite prepared to provide any help or any assistance at all to ritual abuse survivors or survivors of mind control experimentation, be they Native or non-Native. But there is a high level of awareness within the Native community itself about the extent of ritual cult abuse practices. And certainly people who work in the child welfare, the Native child welfare agencies, have come to find a lot of evidence of this practice and a lot of children who have been damaged by it.
What kind of healing practices have been going on in the Native community, and has that been helpful in helping the recovery of Native survivors?
I have been at healing gatherings, and I have been at sweat lodges where elders have gathered together, and they usually know that there has to be a group of them who are going to work with ritual abuse survivors. They have had the most profound healing impact on survivors that I have ever seen. And I often think that personally, I wouldn't be alive if it hadn't been for the assistance of some Native elders here in the Thunder Bay area. I'm very grateful to them for what they've been able to do. And they don't shy away from it or deny it or run away from it, which is not something that I can say about the non-Native healing community itself. There's a great deal of fear in the non-Native community, but the fear isn't there among the majority of elders. And they see the direct equation to what has happened to so many of their people in the residential schools and within the prison system as well. And again, because so many of the residential schools were also found in areas that were near military bases, either U.S. or Canadian military bases, NORAD and the Doom Line certainly had an impact. We're starting to see a lot more evidence of mind control experimentation. I'm assuming it's going to be the same CIA-funded practices that were carried out on non-Native children, again, in that military context.
Lynn, I'd like to talk to you about your own experiences with government mind control experimentation. How do you remember that you first got introduced to this?
My father had been in the Canadian military, the Cape Breton Highlanders, from 1939 to 1945, and my mother was a war bride from Glasgow. They moved from Halifax to Toronto following my birth in Halifax in 1947, and like many other men after the war, my father had the usual difficulty in finding work. And my memories first began with memories of sexual abuse by my father, my uncle, and there were a group of his army buddies who were also involved in the sexual exploitation of children. And The memories began always with these men who were somehow associated with the military. And I am not sure how it escalated with my father. I am absolutely uncertain about how he came to play a role in this, and he will not talk to me.
Do you know if your father was involved with any potential cults or Masonic
lodges? I have distinct, very, very distinct memories of cult rituals starting at a very early age, and one of them was near the slaughterhouse. I was on Mariah Street in Toronto. I have memories of one taking place near the slaughterhouse in Toronto, in some churches outside of Hamilton and Toronto, different locations there, and also being flown to different places as well, to an underground cult site that again was affiliated with the military. I remember being taken to Uplands Air Base in Ottawa as a child.
And do you have any idea about how old you would have been when this took place?
I have really distinct memories from age 3 onwards, and I have begun to piece together the memories about the experiments themselves bit by bit over the years.
Now, you have done a series of drawings to express your memories of government experimentation, which you've included in one of the Stone Angels journals, and which I found to be very disturbing. Can you tell us how these drawings came about and what they mean to you?
The drawings were very puzzling to me for a very long time. I found myself doing drawings of children who seemed to be wearing helmets, and there was always an electrical outlet nearby. There was always some kind of indication about electricity being used. And over time I began to realize what I was trying to say with these drawings, because I was unable to say any of these things in words. Mm-hmm. It has only been in the past, I would say, 6 or 8 months that I am somewhat able to articulate what is contained in the drawings. There is one drawing that describes a series of memories that I had about having my limbs dislocated at the shoulders and at the hips, and then being wrapped up with rolls of bandage to create a portable sensory deprivation unit, if you like. And what was said about what was being done to me was, first we break you, then we make you. And I can remember looking at the drawing when I finally did it and realizing that this was a very, very simple technique for anyone in the military, or not even necessarily the military. If someone wanted to begin the process of torture on an individual, they would be able to carry rolls of bandage as part of a first aid kit, or it could be as simple as carrying rolls of bandage in a brown paper bag, and no one would know that you were about to begin breaking a person's mind.
And this is really exactly what the intentions of Dr. Cameron's projects at McGill were designed to do. I mean, he publicly stated that he wanted to remove a person's personality,
yes,
totally break them down,
yes,
and to rebuild and put in a new personality according to their designs.
Actually, as not a new personality per se, but a series of locked and interconnected personalities or components that could only be brought forward by keywords or key phrases, telephone programming, and you were made to learn how to respond. You weren't made to learn, you were made to respond and made to be cued internally by the application of electricity and by different torture procedures, again, as a child, so that the telephone could be used really effectively. Again, it's very simple. It could be as simple as someone 1,000 miles away wanting to make contact with that part of you, and all they had to do once the training had been completed was to pick up a phone, give you a cue word, and then that component within yourself would be activated to follow through on any instructions or suppression material that they might want to implement at that time. I have very distinct memories about different sensory deprivation techniques as well. There were a series of constructed rooms, some of which became smaller while you were in them, and then other containers, such as barrel-shaped containers in which you were placed. Your arms and your legs, everything would be bound, and you would be wrapped up that way and put inside a container. And these are just the systematic techniques to begin isolating you. And then things accelerated to the use of you and Cameron's helmets. The song Home on the Range seems to be something that was used in my programming. And there was another experiment, again with the use of a helmet, and tubes were placed over my arms so that I was unable to move my arms or my hands, or I guess defend myself or have any tactile sense at all. And there are also drawings of, I remember also being put in, I had no idea what I was describing at the time, but I certainly knew what the effect and the impact was. There were chambers And all I can remember is this huge, what I would call a huge coil at the end of the chamber. And I was put in there, and then something happened, and it had to do with that coil. And I can remember wanting to rip the top of my skull off when I started to remember about being put in. There were two of them. One was larger than the other. I wanted to kill myself and rip the top of my skull off. I can't even put into words what the effect of those coils were. I was part of the part of some of the projects that were funded by a University of Rochester in the late 40s and the early 50s. The three key research points in a funding triangle were Los Alamos, University of Rochester, and Stanford University. The Dr. Cameron certainly had an affiliation with those research groups, which were conducted in secrecy in Upper State New York. And another Canadian is Dr. George Estabrooks, and there's a very worth noting silence about Dr. Estabrooks. He was located at Colgate College in Hamilton, New York, and he had an affiliation with Oswego State Teachers College with Rochester. He was originally born in Newfoundland, and Canadians can know that Dr. Estabrooks was instrumental in creating the U.S. versions of the Manchurian candidates. He had been in direct contact since 1937 with J. Edgar Hoover and was affiliated with Jose Delgado, with Martin Oren, with Ewan Cameron, certainly, with the practitioners of mind control brainwashing experiments. There is a long-standing history there that needs to be brought forward.
Right, and he's published many writings of his own detailing or giving us some details of his work in trying to create Manchurian candidates. Just for the benefit of listeners that may not be familiar with that term, is using a person under the influence of mind control to commit assassination. Of course, many other political and military espionage acts, as we'll get into a bit later. Just also to familiarize listeners with the work of Jose Delgado, he was involved in also the same kind of work.
I don't really even want to use the word doctor. I will say torturer. Jose Delgado was one of the men who performed experimental procedures on me as well as Dr. Ewan Cameron. And he had experimental sites constructed within a building. One was called the Fun House and one was called the Playhouse. And I had been wired up to perform like a robot, and electricity was used to control my movements and my actions. And I was taken to a place that I can only recall as the Land Vehicle Division, and the work that Jose Delgado was doing was somehow related to this military installation. And because I would have been taken there in a drug state and as a child, I am not sure of the location of that particular place, but I know it was Jose Delgado because it has come up over and over again.
Do you know what kind of things the government has used you, using mind control? What kind of operations were you involved in?
In many cases, it literally is to carry information and to be used for blackmail purposes, for pedophilia among high-ranking people who either have to be brought into the fold or reminded of their place in the hierarchy. There are certainly the assassin programs. That is a very hard one to come to grips with inside yourself when you start to remember exactly what your hands have been taught to do. And there are there
are many, many instances. In Jonestown always comes up the experimentation that was done at Walla Walla. There seem even to have been some assassin programs produced at Oak Ridge Penitentiary here in Ontario in the late 60s, early 70s, under a programming and LSD experiment that was carried out in that institution. I know I was used to blackmail a British researcher, a British scientist, and in a faculty building setting. At one point, I found myself as a child in bed with this older man who was crying, and there was a camera trained on him, and he had been drugged. I had been drugged as well, and here I was, a child with, of course, no clothes on. He had no clothes on, and he was crying and crying about what was he going to tell his wife, what was he going to tell his wife, and there were three people standing at the end of the bed, and it had to do with one of the projects that they were working on at that time, and this particular British researcher scientist was, it was essential that he become complicit to what they were going to carry, what they were going to carry out.
Mm-hmm.
And
have you heard other accounts of children being used operationally for these sexual blackmail, essentially?
Yes, there are hundreds of stories like that, hundreds of them. And I think what I find, not just the sadism of these military researchers, these scientists, not just the sadism and their absolute total disregard for anything that we would put under the definition of human or humanity, but there seems to be a predilection among almost all of them for pedophilia with either male or female children.
Right.
And that seems to be a common bond with them.
What were some of the similarities between the accounts of survivors that you have come across as in your work with HMC and with the Stone Angels?
Right. Well, some of the things that children who've been involved in ritual abuse describe is the use of cages, electricity, the use of drugs. These are also things that come up in the production of pornography and any investigation of the production of pornography itself. In the mind control experiments, again, the use of electricity is essential and has been refined over time. The use of drugging to obtain compliance or to literally experiment with children to see what the effects of certain drugs will be. The use of torture, use of sensory deprivation, psychic driving, the use of the children who are involved in the mind control experimentation to carry secrets, to be used for pedophilia in order to blackmail certain individuals in the research and military community so that their compliance is gained.
You were aware of other people, around, other survivors, other people that were being experimented upon. Were these, for the most part, children or a mixture of men and women, or...?
The survivors that I personally am most in contact with, because they're the ones that I share the most with, are the child survivors of experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly many survivors who were introduced onto these experimental technologies and this torture as adults at different colleges and universities. And in other ways. I guess I'm thinking, excuse me, I'm thinking that it is easier to believe that a prisoner or an adult was subjected to unethical experimentation because we have seen a published and a broadcast history of what was done to adults. It's really, really essential that the child survivors' stories are brought forward, and that as a society we understand the depth and the length that the research institutions in Canada and in the United States, the length and the depth that they will sink to and go to devise more and more refined techniques so that they can brainwash the populace.
Through your memories of the time when you had undergone these experiments, what was your sense of how many other people were involved in being experimented upon at that time?
I was taken to laboratory settings where people had been held for a long time. I saw evidence of children having been born in these laboratory settings.
And they being used as well?
Yes. And the genetic experimentation that was going on. I remember being in one place where, in the 50s, and there were what I call torso babies. They were little babies. They had beards and they didn't have any arms and legs. And when I did the drawings, all I could call them was the torso babies. And a friend who's a nurse looked at them and said, "Oh my God, that must have been something like thalidomide being used that way in these hidden laboratories." I know that some of the survivors who have come forward talked about having been given different drug regimes when they were 8 or 9 years old to bring puberty on, so that they were able to become reproductive much earlier than they normally would have, and they have been very damaged by what was done to them at age 8 or 9 in terms of their genetic makeup.
What is the role of the various kinds of druggings that they had used within the experimentation?
That is such a huge question. To make someone unconscious and therefore malleable is certainly one. I think they were also experimenting to see which of the drugs would make someone more susceptible to brainwashing. Probably efficiency is a word I could use. Time management, cost efficient. Which drug was going to make it easy? Which drug is going to make it easier and quicker to begin the brainwashing process, to begin the patterning that needs to take place? I also know that there is some parallel research going on in Canada in the Native community itself as well. And when I look at the electric chair that was constructed at the Fort Albany Residential School up by Moosonee and Moose Factory, where the children were put in that electric chair and made to jump and squirm with electricity for the entertainment of the visiting dignitaries. That was back in the 50s. I'm really, really wondering what role the military mind control experimentation has played in what has happened to the Native community across Canada.
Right.
And I have memories of being in one place where there was an Inuit woman who had a very, very small infant with her. Her head had been shaved, and I'm wondering what happened to some of the patients who were sent down to southern Ontario or across the border into the States for tuberculosis treatment in the 50s and 60s.
Right.
Or